Attention! A new episode of Cooking with Drag Queens is now being served. On the menu, Erica Clash.
For her episode of Cooking with Drag Queens, the fresh and fruity Erica Clash dressed up as a strawberry to pay tribute to Strawberry Shortcut, the short film by Tom Rubnitz starring Lady Bunny as a ladies' luncheon hostess who experiences severe dessert distress.
Today, Erica Clash, the outlandish drag queen who looks like she jumped out of a Japanese anime film, joins us to chat about her latest episode of Cooking with Drag Queens. On season 2 of the web series Dragula, Erica was stabbed, shot, and worst of all, forced to tell the truth. But could she handle cooking with drag queens? Why does she insist on eating her cat-shaped ice cream cone without using any hands?
Plus, will the success of the series Pose impact the future of RuPaul's Drag Race?
A sneak peek into Dragula Season 3.
And why are so many reality TV shows getting vegans to eat meat?
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Become a member and support this show at feastoffun.com/plus.
Hello?
I took the shortcut, the strawberry shortcut.
Oh my God, that's been stuck in my head all day.
How you doing, Erica?
I'm doing okay, you know, the usual ups and downs of life, but still here, still doing it.
I really enjoyed working and editing your new Cooking with Drag Queens episode. Now hot and fresh for the world to see with Erica Clash.
It was so fun to watch.
Category is fresh fruit.
Category is drinking my own blood. Category is dry ice. Category is eating Hello Kitty alive, which is probably my favorite part.
For a second, when you were saying drinking your own blood, I was like, what? We did that? I was like, well, we made a cocktail inspired by your blue blood in season 2 of Dragula.
Absolutely.
A lot of people don't realize we taped that shortly after your elimination on Dragula.
Yes, I remember the day that we taped that, we went and watched the following episode after I was sent home.
Yeah,
in your apartment. Yeah, oh my God, that feels like so long ago, almost a year and a half ago now.
Yeah.
The show has, obviously our season is done, and we're getting ready for season 3 to come out.
It won't be as good as season 2, though, I'm sure.
Hopefully we'll be making some history this year on Dragula.
What kind of history?
Well, rumor has it, and I don't know anything, by the way, on like who's been cast or anything other than, you know, what's out there on the street. But rumor has it is that we have performers, you know, drag king performers on this year. We have, for lack of a better term, AFAB drag queens on this year. So it's going to be a really exciting season, I'm sure.
So how soon do they get eliminated off the show? I'm just kidding.
I have no idea anything related to season 3. I don't live in LA, so I'm not like, you know, in the inner knowings of what's happening.
Did the Boulay brothers not get the memo from RuPaul that no titty queens allowed?
Oh my God, you know, it's just like, and you know, every time I talk to people about Dragula, I always like kind of throw that little shade at RuPaul because like I don't want to hate on RuPaul because she's obviously done so much for us. However, You can't really invoke the memory of Marsha P. Johnson, a trans woman of color, and then like say what you say about Peppermint not having breasts and therefore she's still eligible. But you know, like RuPaul's from a different time, and that's not a read. Right. It's just me saying like she has a different set of criteria, and like Drag Race is only one vision of what a successful career in drag is, and like the world has evolved a lot since RuPaul first came on the scene. So hopefully she can be educated and can change her views, but I don't know, man. It's not a good prognosis.
You know, because it's really, it's weird. It's this bigotry against breasts. It's like we've seen the girls on Drag Race that have had their butts done. We've had the cheek implants, you know, and everything. You know, the Botox and everything on hormones, everything. But for whatever reason, when it comes to a big old pair of jugs that don't come from like the fast food diet, RuPaul's just like, no titties.
I actually just got to watching the season 11 reunion, and they were talking about fillers and how it's kind of a given. It's something that you need to have if you're going to go on. I mean, this is not my words. This is I think Vanjie was mentioning, you know, if you don't have fillers, you're not going to win. And so I think, well, one side of that is that, yes, there's, you know, drag queens have had a much bigger budget now, especially the ones that go on All Stars. You know, they have a bigger budget, so they can get their lips done, or they can get fillers and whatnot. But on the other hand, like the concept of transition has evolved so much more than just getting, you know, genital reassignment surgery or all those typical things that you think of when you think of, okay, they had a sex change, now it's done. The transgender experience, from my understanding, is so much more complex than that. So to reduce it just to body parts or just to that kind of stuff, not only kind of betrays that sort of previous concept about like you have to have fillers in order to win, but it's also just not really representing the trans experience, in my view.
Or the drag experience as trans.
Or the drag experience as a trans person. So I definitely think Drag Race has some work to do as far as that, and as far as not being super homogenous with the casting.
It's just one TV show, and we have Pose, and we have Dragula, and we have Cooking with Drag Queens, and we have Camp Wanakiki, and even your sister, Abora, congratulations, won Alaska's Drag Queen of the Year contest.
Yes, and look at that. Like, what an inclusive competition, celebrating all forms of drag, all kinds of drag. Super exciting. And so my hope is that, like, instead of shaming or criticizing people that we don't agree with, we just have to add our own voices to the conversation, you know? And so Dragula is a big part of that. And as you mentioned, like Camp Wanakiki, all these things are just another part of that. So I never want to be anti-Drag Race or like anti-RuPaul, but I think that, but you know, like I am a child of the Drag Race generation, and Drag Race changed my life. So if something means something to you, then you should, you know, be able to kind of objectively criticize and critique it.
I feel like with season 11, at this point, we're just sort of seeing the same kind of material and the same type of performer over and over again. You don't have that sort of watershed moment, for example, with Sharon Needles or with Bianca Del Rio, where we started getting excited and changing the way we think about cross-dressing in art and in drag.
Yeah, very that. I mean, I do feel a little bit disappointed with just their casting choices the last couple of seasons.
Is that something that they can sustain at all? I mean, are we being too hard on World of Wonder having to sort of reinvent the wheel every single year?
Well, look, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. Like, you know, if you look at the ratings, more people are watching Drag Race than they've ever watched before. The question is it the queer community supporting it, or is it the dominant culture supporting it? I tend to think it's the dominant culture that really supports Drag Race. And then you have the sort of mainstream of gay culture that will go out to the bars and watch it as well. So it really is a question of, you know, how much are they going to tailor their casting choices and the tone of the show to this new audience that they have? You know, Sharon Needles, Jinx Monsoon, Bianca Del Rio, like that was the age of, you know, Drag Race was still a niche show.
But even if, like, talking to them at the time, they felt very much that they had been roped into accidentally stumbled upon a phenomenon, whereas a lot of the queens that are on Drag Race now have been strategizing for a good decade on how to succeed on the show. You know, you look at someone like Nina West, she's been thinking and auditioning all this time, and so she's really had a time to sort of mature as an artist.
She was also doing drag well before Drag Race.
Correct.
Season pageant queen and has a long, long, long resume of like servicing her community. So she's a unique case in my view. And she's actually one of my personal favorites on this season because I got that realness, that authenticity, that sense of also that sense of camp, that sense of, I don't want to say old school, but sort of like classic, you know, drag that's, you know, of the community, for the community. And it's just all about spreading joy.
But, you know, you look at her face and she looks like she's like, what the fuck did I get myself into?
Yeah, she looked like Harvey Fierstein in that movie Duplex with Drew Barrymore and
what?
Ben Stiller. Yeah, have you ever seen that movie?
No,
Harvey Fierstein is amazing. It's a Danny DeVito movie, and Harvey Fierstein cons Drew Barrymore and Ben Stiller. It's great. It's great.
Part of it is like I run into people who are fans of Drag Race and fans of what we do, and they inevitably, they're like, the first thing out of their mouth is like, you don't like Silky Ganache, do you? And I'm like, Silky Ganache, I consider a person in my community. She has been nothing but sweet and nice and kind. And the person that we saw on that show may be a little bit of creative editing and a lot of nervous anxiety manifesting itself into somebody that doesn't necessarily align with my experience of who Silky Ganache is.
Absolutely. And if there's anything that I've learned coming away from Dragula, it's that you don't have to be inauthentic to be in a different way on a TV show. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily inauthentic. It's just a different side of her that she's maybe choosing to share for the cameras. So I really try to separate my opinion of someone on the show versus them off the show. You know, you have to remember that, you know, there's so many different factors that, you know, just play into who you're going to show up as on that day.
At this point, as a Dragula girl, can you audition for other TV shows like Drag Race?
Yes, I am. I just don't know if that's really in my interest at this time.
Sure. But you wouldn't say no to it if it was offered to you, would you?
Yeah, I mean, I always tell people, like, never say never. And this goes for a potential all-stars of Dragula as well. You know, never say never, but it's just not something that's on my mind right now.
Well, in Dragula, you were shot at, you were stabbed, you were forced to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I'm cooking with drag queens. We sort of washed down that disgusting, what was it, brains that you had to eat.
It was so many things, girl. It was so many things.
With a nice kitty cat ice cream cone.
It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Because I had seen you, we've known you for so long, and it's like, and I saw you sort of putting yourself in a very precarious situation. In a lot of ways, like, a lot of people just thought of you a very heroic figure because of the way you just unapologetically face these challenges. And so I just wanted to give you dessert. I felt like
dessert was
what we needed after a cool, refreshing caramel vanilla ice cream cone shaped like a cat.
And you know what? Once the cameras turned off, we definitely chowed down, I remember.
Well, when the cameras are rolling at the end of the episode, you, for some reason, didn't want to use your hands. You went face down into a caramel cat ice cream cone sundae.
I know. Oh, I remember that. I wonder why. I think, again, me probably just trying to be extra for the camera.
Was it because they forced you to eat things on Dragula without your hands?
Did they? I don't remember. No, we had a fork and knife.
That was a challenge that they put all sorts of gross stuff in front of you. And then
I think you're thinking season one,
I'm confused. Yes, I'm confusing the brain episode.
Yes.
It was a banquet. It was indoors that you did. Their season one was outdoors in the desert.
Yeah, they were in Death Valley that episode.
And that wonderful statement by
Loris.
Loris.
She
was vegan, and she was like, I'm not going home. What did she say exactly?
I think it was a little bit of Mandela effect because Meatball in the next episode said not tonight, but Loris actually said not today.
Yes. And she was like, she was either forced to send home or eat brains, and she was a vegan. And a lot of, like, the Belay brothers got in a little bit of trouble for that.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, people are like, you are forcing vegans to eat animal
products.
But
we did talk to them about it, and they said that there was actually a questionnaire that was sent out, and nowhere did she list that she was allergic or unwilling to eat meat.
But even if she had, like, I don't think that vegan is, like, being vegan. I mean, people choose to live the vegan lifestyle, right? I don't, you know, so it's like you can, there are many different reasons that any particular one person can choose to be vegan.
Mm-hmm.
When Mark was on the Norwegian reality TV show Alt for Norge, there were some vegans on the show, and then one of the challenges was to eat a hot dog.
One person didn't eat a hot dog, but she later on, the two vegetarians did eat some fish-based products, and I was like watching them eat it, and I'm like, I can't believe they're eating this, and I know they're going home at the end of this episode. I knew that there was a seismic change, you know, when they ate that meat, that I just knew that there was, like, in some ways they'd given up.
I don't think it's such a big deal. You can always choose to, I don't know, maybe you don't like eating meat, but you can maybe choose mm-hmm. to for a particular purpose. I don't think a vegan would like gag. I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't know.
It's a moral question. It's like for them to eat meat is like you might as well just ask them to like kill the animal right in front of you, you know.
But is that like even when we made pad thai with Trixie Mattel, one of the most so much anger to this point to this day. There's thousands of fans who are like, you forced Trixie Mattel, who's a vegan, to eat shrimp paste. And at the time,
is she vegan?
She publicly identifies as vegan, but in a subsequent interview, she clarified. She said it was fine with it,
and we were okay. We asked her like during the taping, but it did not make it into the final edit. Are you okay with this? And she's like, yeah, it's fine. And I'm gonna out her. She eats chicken McNuggets, so there.
I mean, who doesn't? I love me some chicken McNuggets, but for a lot of different reasons, I've considerably cut down on meat, but that's more to do with health reasons and also just the industrial like meat complex is crazy. And so like I just choose not to participate. That doesn't mean that bacon doesn't, you know, smell good anymore. I love eating meat, but I eat it in much more moderation. So it's a question of like, is a vegan like an inherent identity or is it just a behavior choice? And I tend to think it's a behavior choice, but I'm not vegan, so I don't know.
But what's more controversial, to say that you don't support trans people in drag shows or to say you're okay with vegans eating meat to drag fans?
Well, I think that's an obvious answer.
But it inspires a lot of passion about it. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm just like, RuPaul's Drag Race wants to continue and being the juggernaut that it is, inevitably it's going to, they're already sort of quoting, you know, pose, you know, with a tens across the board. Inevitably you're going to have those elements manifesting themselves on the show. They just can't help not to.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it really is packaging like queer culture, drag culture, gay culture, whatever you want to call it. It's packaging it in a way that people can understand. And I think one of the great things about Drag Race, you know, if I'm looking at it as if I were maybe a straight person who doesn't know a lot of gay people or know drag queens, they really do a lot of great work to humanize mm-hmm. the people on the show. Mm-hmm. Some of it to me comes across a little bit, for lack of a better word, kind of didactic or like heavy-handed or... I mean, but then again, I'm a trained eye. I'm somebody that's of the queer community. So these conversations are not new, but to someone who's not of the queer community. Yeah. It's really amazing to mm-hmm. see, these people kind of represented for what they are, which is artists, business people, queer, you know, queer people making a way for themselves in the world. So I love all of that stuff. And I think there's real value to that. It's just kind of tired for me to deal with.
On Cooking with Drag Queens, you chose to represent yourself as a strawberry, and getting a lot. Now, the episode is not public yet. It's public now. You go to youtube.com/feastoffun and watch it. And a lot of people are commenting about your strawberry outfit and how the most craziest comment I got is from my own mother. She's a little old, so she thinks that I'm you.
Oh my God. I saw that and I loved it. And I was like, how the fuck? Cause our faces are very different.
We're both Puerto Rican.
So we're both Puerto Rican.
Are you a Chicago Rican?
I'm a Puerto Rican San Juan baby.
Oh, wow. Yes, see, I'm a New Yorker. I grew up in New York City my whole life. I know that Chicago has a big Puerto Rican community though, right?
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the old Norwegian neighborhood. Became the Puerto Rican neighborhood.
Well, you know what's funny about that outfit, by the way? Perfidia actually gave me that outfit. I feel like I bought it off her for like $50. She didn't want it anymore. I was like, I've got to have this. By the way, I love going to Perfidia's house whenever I'm in New York. I was last there back in December. I bought a bunch of wigs from her. And every time I go, it's just an explosion of like all things Harajuku, all things kawaii. Like mm-hmm. she has wig upon wig. She has like all the... It's always just a masterclass in like everything Harajuku whenever I go there.
Well,
it's incredible.
If you watch her episode, we did an episode of Cooking with Drag Queens with her, and you can see a bit of her apartment in the episode. And I'm just so amazed by all her little dolls that she has and the wigs that she's making for people.
Yeah. Like it's a museum as much as it is somebody's house. Mm. And like I bet you she's been there since for a long time because she lives like in the East Village, which as of now, is probably super, super expensive.
Rent control, gosh, she has
rent. Rent control, 90s rent control, bitch. You gotta love
She's
it.
She's paying $200 for that apartment.
I wouldn't move either, and I wouldn't move either if I were her. Mm. You know.
Well, are you like in rent control? Because you lived in New York City for a while. Do you have to inhabit the apartment, or is it? How does that work exactly?
Oh, girl, I'm sure there's gray areas in how that works, but...
They can't kick you out unless they have, like, a family member move in or something like that, I think. Is that how something like that works?
Yeah. So people
it also depends if it's an apartment complex, an apartment building, or if it's, you know, a private house. Like, a private house, it really depends on who owns the house. For example, here in San Francisco, there's a lot of... I mean, obviously, there's a big housing crisis, but you have people living, you know, as a tenant in someone's house, and you're kind of at the mercy of whoever owns the house, you know? Mm. So if they want to knock it down and turn it into a tech dorm, you know, literally a dorm for tech people... they can do that. And so that's kind of the issues that we're dealing with here in the Bay Area, by the way.
Mm. And massive amounts of human feces.
Yes. Well, that's the thing too. Like there's a lot of homeless in the Bay Area, and there are not a lot of private bathrooms. So this is what you get, you know, when the 1% goes ham, you have people shitting in the street. And I don't think anybody wants shitting in the street.
The solution is just Facebook needs to open up their building to the homeless.
Mm-hmm. Right. And one of the things that I deal with in my day job, you know, I work front of house for an art center in downtown San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have a lot, and we're right across the street from the big convention center. So you have like, you know, 1%er, you know, tech executives like 10 feet away from homeless people just trying to use the bathroom. So, crazy times we're living in.
Mm. What's been the biggest change in your life in the years since we filmed Cooking with Drag Queens and now?
Yeah. Well, we just had our 2-year anniversary of moving to the Bay Area. And
you and your partner.
Yes, my partner Johannes and I moved here in March of 2017. And that was 4 months before I got the call for Dragula. So all of the change kind of happened very, very fast.
Since appearing on Dragula, you have a much, much bigger fan base. And sometimes we get accused of that. Like, people are always like, you're just chasing after celebrities. And I'm like, honey, we've been talking about getting you on Cookie with Drag Queens for 2 years before you got onto Dragula.
Yeah, which is so funny. Like, I met you that year at Austin Drag Fest. I met Peaches Christ that year. I met the Boulay Brothers for the first time that year. Mm. So shout out to Austin Drag Fest, by the way, which was, you know, a major, major, like, reason why I had such a great space to kind of cultivate my talent and, like, a great way to build a network. You know, moving here and Dragula, like, all of it together has just been such a big rebirth creatively. And I think for the first time... I felt, you know, here in the Bay Area in the drag scene, like I had a group of people that I could really depend on creatively. And it's really, really been exciting. Not without its challenges, of course. I don't know. If I had to narrow it down to one major thing, yeah, it would definitely be Dragula. I mean, I walked out of that experience, you know, with a whole new outlook on my drag. And even where my drag was when we taped Cooking with Drag Queens, you know, it was in the process of evolving.
What has happened since then?
I've been touring. I started producing my own show here in San Francisco.
What is it?
It's called Pastel Gore, and it's a nerdy punk drag show. So it kind of takes all the things that you love about San Francisco drag. For example, a big tradition here is themed shows. So every month we do a different nerdy theme. And, you know, we have, you know, games with the audience and all that kind of stuff that we come to love about San Francisco drag, just putting it through a nerdy lens. And so some of our shows are spooky. Some of our shows are really campy. Some of our shows are just trashy. And yeah, I'm just really excited to see where that goes. We just started a monthly at our new space in the Castro. And, you know, before that, we were kind of just making the rounds here in the Bay Area. We got to perform a set at Oaklash, which is the Bay Area's first ever drag, you know, queer performance festivals. So that's been really exciting. And to just sort of have a place to experiment every month and try out new things while also being able to tour and to like share the gospel of Dragula and to get to see all of these upstart performers, monster drag performers, just producing their own content and kind of taking the reins. You know, not only are they really building a community in their home city, but they're helping to keep us employed and keep us booked. And it's been really great. And it's been a learning, a really great learning experience of just, you know, building drag as a business. You know, I've been doing this, you know, one person business for almost 2 years now. And it's really starting to feel like I'm getting into a groove with it. So that's just been, you know, most of my experience since Dragula is just kind of getting the most out of it still.
Considering how far they pushed the contestants last season, what do you expect to see in this season? Is there going to be as much physical danger as in the past?
Well, I would love to see some sort of like get into drag in the New York City subway challenge or something. A photo shoot in the New York City subway tunnels. That would be sickening.
A lot of these reality TV shows are very much idealized locations. Like, since we taped our show, I was a judge and helped film the first season of Camp Wanakiki.
Yes,
and
which
one thing
I love.
That struck me was just how emotionally hard it is to get sent home on those shows. And I don't know if you had that reaction to it, maybe because they filmed it differently, was watching people be sent home as devastating for you guys as it was for us.
You know, in a lot of ways, it was kind of a relief. I got the call and I was disappointed, but at the same time, I mentioned this in the interview that we did, mm-hmm. But I just felt like, you know, there was just a disconnect and I just wasn't clicking. And so I kind of felt like, you know, maybe it is for the best that Abora moves forward. And doesn't mean that I'm a failure. It doesn't mean that I'm a horrible drag queen. It just means that I wasn't what they were looking for. And I also felt like the whole experience really energized me, like going through all those extermination challenges and also getting to have my drag, you know, under the microscope and to get it really critiqued and to learn from what I was seeing around me was just, that was a great part of the experience. And that really energized me going forward. So it was a mix of kind of disappointment, but like, all right, well, let's just move on to what's next. You know, I had so much to look forward to.
And the queen with the Pinocchio nose on your season.
Yes.
I'm blanking on her name right now.
Abora.
She won Dragula's new pageant.
Well, it's not Dragula's.
Well, she won Alaska's pageant.
Yeah, Alaska's
America's
pageant.
Next drag.
And I'm so happy for her.
Drag queen of the year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm so happy for her. So sickening that someone from Dragula took that home, and it bodes well for, you know, our movement and what we're trying to create. So,
what are the Dragula girls all about? What is the Dragula movement representing?
Well, I look at it as sort of reclaiming the countercultural nature of drag. So, you know, in my view, like the Drag Race has sort of made everything very easily packaged and family friendly, and in some ways uncomplicated. It really does, you know, serve a lot of the popular discourse around, you know, LGBT culture and acceptance of gay people. And none of that is bad. But I just want to, you know, through Dragula, highlight the nature of, you know, the history of drag as being a countercultural movement, being in your face, punk rock. So that's really what I think of when I think of what, you know, when I say the movement is sort of like bringing some of that back. And also, you know, pushing back against conformity, homogeneity, and welcoming difference of opinions, welcoming a difference of ideas. I see some of those things kind of blanching away with Drag Race. I see the casting become very homogenous. So, you know, part of what I was trying to get done on season two was, you know, to really help people understand my view of drag and to establish that view of drag as valid. And I think that everyone on Dragula who has maybe feels that maybe they have a different point of view, you know, should do that as well. And you know, so even for me being different among a group of queens who were already kind of labeled as different, was challenging but rewarding and validating for a lot of my fans and the people that I inspire.
You know, and the funny thing about it is, it's like with a lot of these reality TV shows, I see a lot of these drag performers sort of buttons being pushed or pressed into doing something they're not comfortable doing. And with Cooking with Drag Queens, we sort of started doing it almost as a joke, right? It was a, It was just something we were doing with the drag queens that were coming into our home, and it evolved into sort of like a therapy for the drag queens and sort of celebrating and nurturing them to some degree.
That's awesome. And I remember watching the first couple of episodes that you did. Like, I remember you made pumpkin pie flan with Pandora Box. Mm-hmm. I remember you did baked Alaska with Alaska and Jinx. These were just such fun moments of, like, you know, getting to see these. I mean, because back then, by the way, I was not doing drag. Like, I started doing drag right when season 6 came out. So for them, for me in that time, these were, you know, people that I had just seen on TV and who I admired and looked up to. And so, like, you know, just cooking with them was a big humanizing moment. And it was also just really, really fun to watch.
Now, have you been watching Pose on Netflix, the FX series?
I've seen the first episode. I'm waiting to binge watch it with my sister.
Honey,
so my sister, I know.
It is good. Get some Kleenex.
My sister, like in the 90s and early 2000s, was, and obviously that's not the same time period as Pose, but she, you know, rubbed shoulders with a lot of people that's sort of adjacent to that community. So, and my sister and I love to binge watch things together. We don't get to see each other that often.
Because you and your sister grew up in New York City.
Yes, but now I live here in San Francisco. But every time that I'm in New York or she's here, we will binge watch things. And so I'm waiting to binge watch it with her. Because I know that's going to be the best way to experience it.
Just get her on the phone and just watch it and enjoy it together. Because
I know,
so
that's what people do these days too. Yeah, we definitely should.
I got to tell you, it is probably one of the best things on television right now. And certainly, you know, besides the Billy Porter as Pray Tell and Dominique Jackson as Electra Abundance. Her stories, Angelica Ross as Candy. They're just really great trans writers, performers, actors, directors involved in this project. And it's just a groundbreaking show. On top of that, it's a delightful show to watch. And the dancing, the performances, the costumes that make them way into the series rival anything that you've ever seen on Drag Race. It really makes Drag Race get a 9 and put up for the chop in terms of the the costumes that are in the dancing that we're seeing. Like, and I don't know, it's a different animal.
And I don't want to sound like I'm oversimplifying the show when I say this, but yeah. From watching the first episode, I got the sense that it really was, in some ways, a dramatization of Paris is Burning. And what I mean by that is that the show is a scripted show, obviously. It's not a documentary, but it puts so much of their experiences in context with the larger, you know, what was going on in New York City in the 80s. And I think that's great, like the Evan Peters character and his wife. And look, that whole storyline that got started in episode 1 was really, really impactful for me, you know, because you get to see the people, this proverbial 1% people and how much they hunger for this kind of culture and how much they... it was just like, I enjoyed that as well, as much as I did the costumes and all of that. I mean, that opening scene was just a gag.
What is that on your lips? Oh, it's just your favorite lip gloss, sperm.
Hey, so I mean, that is my lip gloss of choice, if there ever was one.
Yeah, Dominique Jackson, if she hasn't been given an Emmy this season, the next following season, she's really one of the most astounding, transformative, powerful performers. And, you know, I think she shines better when she's sort of reading other people to filth and she has this indignant, aristocratic voice. But
Is this the mother, the original mother of the House of Abundance?
Yeah, she's the tallest character actor in the show.
Yeah. And then
Dominique Jackson. I guess she's been good friends with Vivacious for years. Vivacious is
another. Is this the person that starts their own house in episode 9?
No. That's Blanca Rodriguez, played by MJ Rodriguez.
She's the Puerto Rican.
Then there's the girl from Trinidad. She's the tall one. Electra Abundance of her House of Abundance. Do you think I just woke up this day and poof, I look like this? No, it takes work, drive, and sacrifice to be a woman of this stature.
Right. No, she has a regality to her that's just so sickening. Even her choice of words. I mean,
What I love about the show that, you know, it's written, it's produced, written, and starring trans people. So it's really wonderful to see these stories up there on the screen like we've never really seen before.
And it gives a good answer to the question, why should we be watching trans people tell their stories? Because these stories are phenomenal and wonderful, and they speak to the human condition. And I think Pose actually does, it delivers on the promise that so many shows, including this podcast, have been trying to deliver for decades. And it brings it in this technicolor, gorgeous, beautifully performed world. And it's just, if you haven't watched Pose, stop everything you're doing right now. Sit down and binge view that. But first, go check out Erica Clash on Cooking with Drag Queens, don't you, honey?
Yes. Yes. Put that first in your playlist. And then I think Pose is on Netflix now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And season two is coming out in 2 weeks.
Oh, so my God. That's amazing.
Because we don't have cable. Or I think I just might end up buying it because I can't like not live without it. I was just like, you know, I had heard such great things about it when it first came out. But then I was like, I'll wait till it gets on Netflix before I check it out. And I'm sorry I waited.
And, you know, it is a show worth supporting because showing the Nielsen ratings people or whoever else that these stories are in demand, is a really great way to get a season two and to get more stories like this out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Were you ever able to get into like standing the ball scene while you were lived in New York?
No, I never did. It's a very, from my understanding, it's a very separate world. Mm-hmm. And from what I've heard, they do want to keep it, I don't want to say exclusive, but I think they're particular about, you know, who gets access to it. They want it to stay, this is just, again, hearsay from what I've heard from other people in New York. They just want to keep it,
underground.
Yeah, they want to keep it underground, which I really, really respect.
Well, when I first moved to Chicago in 95, you know, I had heard about Paris is Burning, and I worked at a restaurant, and most of my coworkers were black, and we were talking about the ball scene here in Chicago. I'm like, oh my God, I want to go to see one of these shows, and they're all like, no. I'm like, what? Like, first of all, the show started 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. You don't know anybody there. If they don't like you, they will kill you. They will pull out a knife, and they will knife you, or they will shoot you. And I was just like, oh, okay then. I guess I won't be going.
And I mean, like, that maybe is a little extreme, but can you blame them for feeling, but can you blame them for feeling territorial or vulnerable? Like, I mean, we're in the age now where I've seen so many, tacky people, and this isn't necessarily white girls or straight girls or girls in general. I know I don't want to be anti-women, but it's usually people who are not of the queer community who are the most disrespectful. Mm.
And that's, I think, you know, where this idea of only a certain type of person belongs on RuPaul's Drag Race stage, which I disagree with, but I understand why, considering, you know, ball culture's desire to protect its integrity and its privacy, how RuPaul's Drag Race is trying to preserve some notion of what drag's roots are. And so, you know, having somebody who has a giant trust fund, who's not part of the queer community, be on a stage on the same level as somebody who's, you know, been dumpster diving until weeks before they got cast on Drag Race, it's just not a fair fight. And if there's a lot of money and there's a career on the line, you know, having someone be sent home who is very marginalized and seeing somebody who has a lot of privilege to take acting, dancing classes, to have, you know, a six-figure wardrobe, it just doesn't become an interesting show because it just becomes a show about the powerful and the rich beating down on somebody who doesn't have the same tools.
Well, and that's the other sort of criticism that I might have about Drag Race is I see a lot of the same designers being used, and I'm not trying to shit on the designers because the work is sickening, but I just think there's a lack of originality and there's a sense of like, and I get it, look, for All Stars in particular, the girls are very busy touring, So they have a lot of budget. Maybe they just don't have a lot of time to like put the shit together themselves. I get it. But it just, it leaves me kind of wanting more, you know? And so I can understand that.
And, you know, we're going to get more. We're going to get new TV shows. Think about how excited. I mean, if you guys hear my voice and how happy I am about discovering Pose for myself. And I know that some of you guys are like, girl, I've been telling you about Pose for over a year now. You were late to the game, you know, but it's like it's a show that really shows us how we're just scratching the surface on LGBTQ culture and see and why representation is not just important because it's part of our liberation. Representation matters because it is the bedrock of our culture. And when we don't have a strong culture, we fall prey to superstition, to misinformation, to anti-vaxxers, Trump supporters, flat earthers, conversion therapy, religious fundamentalists, corrupt politicians. All those kind of things thrive when you don't have a strong culture. And we wouldn't have a strong culture if it wasn't for queer culture in the United States. And so we depend on those shows and these type of communities in order to survive the regressive forces that are part of humanity as well.
Absolutely. And I'll add to that. You know, when I say adding voices to the conversation, what I mean by that is fighting for representation and then using that representation to educate people. You know, I mean, a lot of, you know, conservatives will talk about like marketplace of ideas, da 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 da. And so like, sure, yeah, they're not wrong. We just have to like, it, you know, if we make one contribution to, you know, adding a voice to the conversation, I think we'll be better off. And I think also just to go back to the ballroom scene, you know, we have to have our survival mechanisms, right? So like maybe their survival mechanism is keeping things more underground because, you know, like, as you said, protecting it. So
yeah, nobody likes a tourist.
Yeah. So we have to like protect our spaces, but we also have to let people know why the spaces are worth protecting and what they're all about. We have to reach the right balance. And so I think like,
yeah, honey, but when you're talking about the marketplace of ideas, when it comes to conservatives, you just have a shitty supermarket when the meat is rotting and the fruit is spoiling.
Well, they use that term in a very different way, you know, in terms of like my hateful rhetoric should still be valid, which I don't necessarily agree with. But, you know, if we use that same logic to our favor and we say to ourselves, we have a responsibility to represent ourselves accurately and as comprehensively as we can, while also protecting our safe spaces, I think we'll get closer to that balance of, you know, feeling like we're a part of the culture, but still being counterculture. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, I just don't want to rely on a TV show in order to get healthcare. You know what I'm saying? Like,
oh, absolutely. Like, well, yes. Well, for that reason, everybody should needs to go vote in 2020. But you know, as far as the cultural, like, as you say, representation, I think we're getting closer to that balance.
Besides the strawberry, are you dressing up as any other kinds of fruit these days?
Well.
So you did the strawberry. It was a one-time deal.
Well, it was an homage to Lady Bunny, right?
Oh, that's right. It was a strawberry shortcut.
Yeah, I mean, loosely. I wasn't going. Yes, sure. I just happened to have that. I just happened to have that dress. Yeah. And I said, I wanted to do a strawberry makeup because we were making ice cream sundaes. I figured that would be appropriate for the theme, but also strawberry shortcut.
But you're so cute. And so, you know, you're like a strawberry. You're fruity. You're delectable. You're tasty, tart.
I'm also prone to getting fungus every now and again. So
and easily bruised.
Another thing that strawberries and I have in common.
And we all want to take a little bite out of you.
Aww.
Oh, well, if I had a dollar for every time somebody said they wanted to take a bite out of me, I'd have 50 cents.
And dip you in whipped cream and lick it off.
Don't forget dark chocolate, honey.
All right, girl. Erica, it's so good to talk to you. And thank you so much for coming in the kitchen and cooking with us.
Oh my God, absolutely. And come back anytime.
Let's make some more ice cream.
I don't wanna put you on the spot, but who are you rooting for to win season 11? And who do you think is gonna get it?
I have to say I'm rooting for Evie Oddly the most out of the ones that are left. I would have wanted Nina West to take it home this year personally. Sure. But I think like Evie's drag being out there benefits me the most just because she is the quote unquote weird one. Mm. So I think like she would break boundaries the most. Silky Ganache, I don't really care for. And Akaria and Brooke, I am sort of indifferent. I don't dislike or strongly like them. Or, I don't, you know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to hate on them, but like.
They don't bring up your passions.
They don't grab me in particular, is what I'm trying to say. Mm. Although I can really appreciate Akaria's drag in particular. Neither of them really excite me or grab me the way that some of the other, like Nina West does, for example. So I guess by default, I would be Team Evie.
Well, if Evie is to win, inevitably she's going to have to dance against Brooke, who's of the four of them, she's the strongest performer in terms of dancing.
Right. And of course, Akaria has so much pageantry experience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, that's like, I always think of the pageant girls and like competing on Drag Race has got to be, I don't want to say easier, but they're used to that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
So who knows? I mean, you know, but I think like Evie winning would probably benefit like alternative drag the most. So therefore I would have to say her.
Yeah, I'm happy everybody is on the show. I think Mark and I both very much reacted very favorably to what Evie's personality and her intellect and her humor on the show. It's not an easy thing to do is to have all these cameras rolling and scrutinizing your every move. Mm-hmm. And we're used to sort of being uplifted and celebrated by our community and our friends and family. And then when we get into the workroom and we go to Los Angeles and they're filming these shows, our whole support network disappears. And then we're just left with 12 other drag queens who are all kind of resenting us for being there because we're in their way of that $100,000 doulas.
Right. Right. And that's the thing too. I think that we're dealing with as a culture or as a community, let's say, the fans are, I mean, people are more vocal than ever, you know, with the internet and, But the fans in particular, I think the girls on Drag Race especially, they really feel a lot of pressure. And so that is coloring, like, you know, all of the kind of interactions that go on camera. And it colors how we kind of take stock of our time on the show.
And they're so aware of it now more so than they ever were before. You know, like those earlier seasons, they didn't realize that if whatever happened, I think they were sometimes a little more freer to do their things because they're like, well, if I say this, I'm not going to necessarily get death threats from 13-year-olds for the next decade. You know?
Right. But they were also not so quick to, you know, jam catchphrases down our throats. Mm. You know, it's just like, watching the last All Stars, I was going through it a little bit. I was just I want to see what these girls have to offer that's not catchphrases. You know,
if Monique Hart had said "Goop" one more time, I was just like, what?
Yeah, and again, like the thing about that is it's not really a reflection of their talent or their creativity or what they bring to the table as a drag artist. It's just them trying to get more t-shirts sold or more whatever's sold. And I think that's, you know, the culture that we're in now with DragCon and everything, it's all about that. And so, you know, and I play some of that game too. I have merch and I push my merch and I do the thing and, you know, all that, but I just want people to remember that the art has to come first.
Erica, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me as always. I'm actually going to be trying to get out to Chicago in July or August. So maybe I'll see y'all then.
Oh yeah. Honey. Stop by and do a podcast with us.
Yeah.
Yay.
I would be a sheer delight to put more cream on your strawberries.
Oh my God. Strawberry shortcut.
And cream.
I took the shortcut.
The strawberry shortcut.
There's that one. There's pickle surprise, and then I feel like there's another one.
There's quite a few of them. The two ones that everybody sees, it's Tom Rubnitz is the creator of them, And he made a bunch of them, but those are the two that sort of made their way to YouTube. And I think Robert Coddington, actually, my friend, he's the one who preserved them off of VHS and got them up onto social media.
And you know what? Somebody needs to write that academic paper deconstructing all of the stuff, because there's a lot of interesting nuance in there, by the way. But anyway, that's a whole other...
Well, the pickle surprise, the whole thing is like, where's the pickle?
You know where it is.
That's the surprise. Right, it's up Lady Bunny's butt.
Well, same.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank y'all so much.
Love you, Erica.
Mwah, mwah, mwah.
You can follow Erica Clash on Instagram and Facebook. She lives in San Francisco with her German boyfriend.
Erica Clash with a K, honey. And of course, Erica Clash on Cooking with Drag Queens, making cat caramel ice cream cones made with dry ice cream, is available on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/feastoffun. You can check out behind the scenes videos, clips, and the full raw uncensored interview from Cooking with Drag Queens at cookingwithdragqueens.com.
I want to remind folks, we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus, because your contribution to the show is what makes this show possible.
That's right, folks. Without your Monty Hunty, we couldn't make Feast of Funty happen. Category is generous donations. I want to see 20s. I want to see hundreds. I want to see $1,000 bills put in our tip jar, darling. You can go to feastoffun.com/donate and turn this frown upside down and make it sunny here, honey, because we need your money to make the show happen. So don't be stingy. Take that tax return and make it rain.
tens of thousands.
Yes, tens, 20s. Whatever you got, American Express will do nicely, thank you. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to sing Tina Turner again?
Please.
Thank you so much for listening.
Bye-bye.
Bye.